Welcome to the current federal tax developments for the week of December the 17th, 2018. Current federal tax developments are brought to you this week, as always, by Kaplan Professional Education's Accounting Continuing Education programs and by your state societies of CPAs. This week, we actually had a lot happen late in the week. It seems kind of obvious that the IRS is getting ready to shut down for the holidays, the IRS and Treasury. And they got a number of things out the door. They need to get out the door here at the end of the week. We'll cover a lot of the stuff they covered into the week. I'll hold a couple for next week that aren't really huge developments, but we'll talk a little bit about them next week and next week's setup, just because we end up with a bunch of stuff that all came down on Friday that we need to handle. This week, though, we'll talk about a few things that happened. We're going to talk about additional proposed regulations issued earlier in the week. So we'll give you a brief highlight of those. We're going to talk about a court case where lack of documentation ended up costing deductions for taxpayers. We've got some more news about the 199 Cap A final regulations and new proposed regulations for 199 Cap A. We'll discuss where that sits. We have guidance issued this week on valuing employer-provided parking for the infamous parking lot tax, and as well some relief for not-for-profits, which this year will have to file a 990T for the first time ever because of the parking lot tax. Finally, we'll talk about a case of an issue for the responsible person penalty for payroll taxes. In this case, we'll talk about taxpayers who were actually out of the country for much of the period, but nevertheless were found to be responsible parties for purposes of paying the payroll taxes. But let's begin by briefly discussing a couple of proposed regs. Not going to really go into detail on these regs because they actually don't really hit the prime audience for this broadcast, given what I find out from talking to people in rooms when I do sessions. But the IRS did issue proposed regulations. This is Regulation 132881-17, issued on December the 13th. This is going to give additional guidance for withholding under FACTA. Now, remember the old FACTA rules? Actually, not a TCJA issue. It's kind of interesting. We get these. It will give additional guidance, which is mainly taxpayer-friendly, on due diligence tests, refunds and credits related to this tax. It actually will remove certain items from having to be subject to the FACTA withholding. And it also is useful because these are mainly reliance regulations, meaning that you can actually use them right away. If you are impacted by FACTA withholding rules, definitely want to go check out these regulations. The other big set of regs, which really probably don't hit most of the people on this broadcast, are the regulations for the Base Erosion and Anti-Abuse Tax, or BEAT. This is Regulation 104-259-18, issued on December 13th of 2018. This is part of the major revision to the foreign taxation systems for corporations. This only affects corporations with over $500 million of revenue, or I should say generally only affects them, which means that since I get a lot of comments at courses, when I talk about, you know, the interest limitation of 163J, immediately a whole bunch of the room dismisses it because they say, well, it only applies if you have over $25 million of revenue. I've got to believe that the majority of the people attending courses are dismissing it because of $25 million of revenue for 163J. It's got to be even a smaller number that have C-Corps over $500 million of revenue. You know, those are going to be somewhat limited. Now, I will admit, one of the sponsors of this program, probably Kaplan, certainly would have over $500 million of revenue and would probably be covered by this. But aside from that, probably not a whole lot of others are. These are proposed rules on the tax. They do run 193 pages. If you are one of those people affected by this, definitely time to go dig into the Base Erosion and Anti-Abuse Tax regulations. The best answer I've heard from people that have looked at them is that they are complicated. They will take some time to digest. They seem to be taxpayer-friendly, but basically, yeah, you really want to dig through there because obviously in all these regulations, detail matters. A generally taxpayer-friendly regulation is not much help for you if it's not friendly in the one area that you have a problem with. Let's move on to our first case of the week and the first thing we have a write-up for on the website. This is the one of Dacent versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2012-202. And before I start this case, I'm going to say this case is not really unique. But it's one of those things I noticed that I hadn't had a case like this on the website in a while. And in a real world, we're actually doing IRS exams with clients. I find that 9 times out of 10, the real issue we run into at the end of the day is not so much some long discussion over a technical issue of how the tax law applies, but most often we are fighting to a large extent about dealing with the adequacy or lack of adequacy of the taxpayer's documentation for various items on the return. it's really important to understand that you've got to communicate with your clients the importance of actually properly documenting returns. Okay, documenting items you're going to claim on the tax return. In this particular case, we have a taxpayer in this situation who is faced with a problem, right? They had a couple of things. Now, this was a self-prepared return. So in one sense, it's probably not surprising that they had lots of issues. Self-prepared returns, by definition, you know, tend to have issues. They had gone off and used TurboTax. This is not going to be a good result, basically, we're going to say. Because, by the way, using TurboTax is not a real good protection against penalties, as the taxpayers in this case would find out to their detriment. The fact that they had been relying on TurboTax, nice guys, but relying on TurboTax doesn't really solve your problem. So what happened in this case was we have a case here with a couple of taxpayers, husband and wife, and they claimed a lot of employee business expenses. Now, before we get started, there was one technical issue of the law that really is in play here. The wife in this case, she basically operated an educational consulting business, she claimed, and she assisted recent college graduates, military personnel reacclimating to civilian life, and at-risk women rejoining the workforce with finding employers. Okay, great. Sounds wonderful. You can have a business doing that. Except here's a problem. She never charged any fees for this, had no plan to charge fees for this, was not looking to make it into a saleable business. Bottom line, as the court noted, the hobby loss rules of 183 wipe that out. What she's doing may be laudable. What she's doing may be something that we'd like people to go out and do. But you know what? We don't provide a tax benefit for doing that unless she was doing it under the supervision of a not-for-profit organization that, you know, went through the whole process of qualifying. So this is much more like just doing something and making donations, you know, making gifts to individuals who may be needy. Wonderful, love it, laudable, but there's no tax benefit for doing so. But the court noted that, you know, even if she hadn't had the hobby loss rule problem, they had problems in other areas. The catch is, because they each claimed employee business expenses, and she clearly was an employee, so was he, so they were employees, we could get something there, and that's prior to 18, of course, but hey, you know, that's what's in court right now, and this rule would apply to you as a Schedule C as well. The problem is you've got to have documentation. Now, we start with this initially. Some of the expenses are subject to the special rules under 274D. 274D essentially says, doesn't matter if you can otherwise show that you had expenses, you know, it's otherwise clear you had to have incurred expenses, and we could reasonably estimate them. If you don't have adequate contemporaneous documentation for certain expenses, those expenses include automobile, you know, any travel-related expenses, which includes automobiles, generally meals. We have a little quirk with that in 18, where meals became less of a 274D item, except for meals on travel. That's probably unintentional by Congress, and the IRS may or may not try to solve this via regulations. We'll see whether they can. That'd be an interesting question. But also for any entertainment expenses. And again, beginning in 18, that doesn't matter. But autos are always a big deal, and autos were the big deal here. In this case, the taxpayers did not have what the courts found were adequate documentations for their auto expenses, right? The problems that we ran into here, the car and truck expenses, right, are subject to limitations. They produced a mileage log, but the log only showed the month and the year for her travel, you know, the names of events that she attended, and, you know, and Bates, you know, on the cities of departure and destination and miles she drove. Didn't include a business purpose or the actual dates of travel. Yeah. You know, basically, that was considered by the court to be inadequate to document auto expenses. Now, be careful there, because you know what? That may be more than a lot of clients when you actually get to exam. I know we've told them they have to have it. When you get to exam, that would probably be a lot for some clients to have. Warn them. And this case is useful for that point. Say, look, these people came into court with this. They came in with information, and this was not good enough. If you want to be able to take the auto expenses, you've got to beat this. Right. And be careful of the client who then says, well, how will they catch me? Well, the same way they catch dissent. They do an exam. And when they catch you, they'll basically hang you to the wall. And at that point, you should be aware that at that point, the client will immediately claim that you said it was OK if you let it go on the return. And don't believe that. Just talk to anybody that defends CPAs, in malpractice cases on tax. And I'll tell you, yeah, they'll hang you right to the wall at that point. So be careful here. Tell clients they've got to have the documentation. If they don't, I can't claim it on the return, because I can't sign a return that has a position that doesn't have at least a reasonable basis. And if there's no documentation, there's no reasonable basis for claiming the deduction. They lose every time in court. This is not a close call. So bottom line, you don't have the documentation. So you're going to tell me you've got the documentation and we get to exam. You don't. Sorry. You're going to be penalized. There's nothing I can do to defend you. And I never, ever, ever have told you that you can claim these deductions without documentation. It's a good idea to put that in writing, guys, because yes, clients do turn on you when things go bad in examinations. Amazing how that works. But hey, they did have some other expenses. Now, those other expenses they tried to claim were not subject to 274D. And we have the old Cohen case. Remember George M. Cohen? We can get things under Cohen without having that detailed level of documentation requiring 274D. But in order to do so, we have to have, first, we have to establish the likelihood that the expenses were incurred. And then secondly, we have to have a reasonable basis for determining how much would be allowed for those deductions. In this case, the problem is, right, you know, there was no distinction made for the expenses they claimed. They just had like their bank statements and monthly expense summaries. They had no breakdown of how much of that was personal, how much was business. They really didn't have any way of breaking it down. They had just kind of guessed on the return. The court found that wasn't adequate. You can't do that sort of thing on the return. Now, here's the final issue. And this one you can actually use, you know, potentially to help yourself when the client says, why don't I just use TurboTax? This taxpayer did just use TurboTax. And the problem in this case is the court very quickly goes down to the, you know, garbage in, garbage out on tax software. The question in this case, because the total tax assessed was greater than $5,000, which was more than 10% of the tax, it should have been shown on the return. So the catch in this case is the automatic substantial understatement penalties under 6662 apply to this taxpayer. Now, there's only three ways to get out of that penalty. Either the taxpayer has to show the position they took had substantial authority. Gang, not happening here. Number two, they have to show that they had reasonable basis and they did the full disclosure. Well, it doesn't really matter here because the issue here is fact, not law. So there's not really much you could do except maybe some vague Cohen defense to try to argue that you were interpreting Cohen to cover this, but that's probably not going to work. And secondly, it didn't disclose anything anyway. Or third, they had reasonable cause and acted in good faith in taking the position. The key test there is, did the taxpayers reasonably try to properly determine their tax liability? The court held very clearly, using TurboTax is not by itself a reasonable attempt to get your tax liability right. It is not the equivalent of seeking out professional guidance and professional advice to help you determine what's deductible, what's not. The court said it's very clear that these people were confused about what they could take and what they couldn't. And the court went on to note that, you know, because of that, you know, reasonably, they should have known to seek out advice. They hadn't done it. So tough luck. They claimed the deduction. They shouldn't have claimed it. You can't blame it on TurboTax. Bottom line, they owe the extra 20% penalty. Okay, now on to something that we've been talking about for quite a while here. The 199 proposed regulations have now gone on to the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs of the Office of Management and Budget. The final regulations were forwarded there on December 14th, okay? They're in for review as of that date. Now, one quirk is they were not designated as economically significant. What that means is, rather than being under the accelerated 10 business day rule for reviewing the regulations, they are under the 45-day rule. So, in essence, OMB has 45 business days, that is, to review these regulations before having to release them back. Seems very likely that we are not going to see these regulations issued in final form by the end of the year. That's important because on the proposed regulations, they wouldn't become effective until they're published in the Federal Register, which seems to likely mean they won't be effective for 18. Now, that said, I wouldn't be surprised to find out that they would have a clause that said, you know, early application is allowed of these regulations, so you may be able to use them on 18. We're still missing some big issues here. Some of the things we're probably looking for guidance here, a lot of people are, is, will there be some sort of safe harbor or better guidance on whether rentals are a trade or business? Will there be some ways of determining how you can divide up a trade or business? You know, can we break a trade or business into two parts, or are we stuck? You know, if it's in one entity, are we stuck with it being one? Seems like the answer is that we've gotten from informal discussions that we've seen at various conferences with various treasury people is it's possible to break them up, but we've never been given real good guidance about how we could break them up, right? All kinds of other little areas in these regs. Will they simplify the allocation of the UBIA, you know, the unadjusted basis immediately after acquisition of qualified property in a partnership? Are they still going to have that rule that says you have to do a, if the property is not currently being depreciated because it was fully depreciated, we now have 100% bonus. So that'll be true 1 year in to a piece of property. Do we have to go back into a computation of a deemed sale at fair market value and apply all the 704 B and C rules in order to determine who would get the gain? We're going to see all those things in there, right? How it's going to go. We're also going to be seeing, they also at the same time put in some proposed regs. There were questions raised about real estate investment trust income, which qualifies for the 20% deduction. What happens if we have a registered investment company, long name for a mutual fund, that's holding REITs? Can it flow through the RIC? Apparently, we're going to have situations where they'll tell us in what situations you can flow through the REIT income, qualified REIT income, through the mutual fund and still get the 20%. That's coming out in proposed form, I assume, because they want some additional comments on what they're going to be doing there. So you're going to see these. Now, these dropped on, as I said, now the proposed regs actually went in a day earlier, but these dropped here on the 13th and 14th of December. Again, the Office of Management Budget has a full 45 days to look at these. And we're talking about heading into weeks where it's kind of obvious that the Treasury was clearing out the stuff they had ready to go. I think it's going to be unlikely that OMB will finish their review and then Treasury will release it and it'll be in the Federal Register before December 31st. So my guess is we are probably going to see these as effective in 19. As well, it seems highly unlikely that they'll even be put on the web in a form saying these have now, you know, these are now ready to go to the Federal Register. So my guess is we won't know the real what's really in these final regs until after the beginning of the year. So if you're waiting for the final regs to do tax planning, yeah, that's probably not going to be a possibility. I would say at this point, you're going to have to move forward with the proposed regs and then take a look at the final regs, see if they give us some better answers. But at the end, as of the end of the year, I think we have to assume as of right now for year-end planning, unless a miracle happens and somehow these all get released next week, my guess is you just got to start looking at those proposed regs. Go through them. We've talked about them before here. I've done courses on them. We've had courses. I'm going to be doing a course this week in Phoenix. That'll be on the tax update. That'll go through them. My guess is we're going to have to use those here at the end of the year. We have no real other option. You're going to have to use those August proposed regulations. We did get one thing that we were looking for, not in this area. If you go forward to notice 2018-99 issued on December the 10th, we got guidance on the infamous parking lot tax. By the way, I'm going to call it that. I realize that that's not what it's called in the law, but that's been the nomenclature because this tax is, shall we say, maybe one of the most ridiculous taxes I have ever seen proposed. And not proposed, but enacted. They propose all kinds of weird things, but actually get enacted. There's a decent chance it will be repealed, but it has not yet been repealed. It does not appear likely at all that we will have anything passed by the end of the year. And I don't think it's going to be the first thing the new Congress will take up next year to try to handle. So we're going to have to work probably at least for this year on the parking lot tax. Under the rules, under the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, we are going to deny a deduction to a for-profit entity, or we're going to treat as unrelated business taxable income the costs of incurred by the employer for providing free parking for their employees. The employee still, you know, unless it exceeds the maximum value for the year that's allowed to be excluded, the employee is not going to pay tax on this thing. Rather, the employer or, you know, the employer has to get a disallowed deduction, or if it's considered to be, you know, it's a not-for-profit and the parking doesn't relate to things that are already UBIT. If it already relates to you, but then don't worry about this special extra tax because we're just going to allow the deduction in computing your unrelated business income. In this case, though, we have to add that in and treat it as unrelated business taxable income. As we discussed a couple weeks ago, that's on this year's Form 990-T. Now, if you actually, what this ruling tells us is how to compute the number. First, this was never a question. If I'm actually paying a, let's say I'm paying a parking garage X dollars per space for my employees, they can park there. Because like I said, I'm located in a downtown location. That's going to be the amount of disallowance. If you're a charity, that's going to be the cost that has to be considered unrelated business taxable income. Okay, that's easy. We never thought we had a problem with that. The bigger problem is going to come in the range of if we actually own the lot. If you own or lease the lot, the IRS has a detailed list of things that are considered to be parking expenses. So we have these particular issues. They said it's not limited to, but it talks about things that are definitely in there. Repairs, maintenance, utility costs, insurance, property taxes, interest, snow and ice removal, leaf removal, trash removal, cleaning, landscape costs, parking lot attendant expenses, security, and rent or lease payments. Oh, yeah, that last one. If you're renting your building, you got to figure out how much of your rent is going to be considered to be assigned to the parking lot. If you don't have it broken out, you got to figure out how much of your total rent for what you're renting is the value of the parking spaces you're renting. Okay? So you get now your total expenses. Now the question is, how do we determine of our total expenses for our parking that we have? Because we're going to take the total for all parking. How do we determine how much of that we lose because we have employees that are allowed to park free? This is where we get to a four-step calculation. We have, if we own or lease the lot, there are four steps we're going to take. And in some cases, we're going to have a way to just simply get to nothing. My CPA firm, I have done the numbers on, we will not have a disallowance. We'll go down how this works. First thing you take a look at is, do you have any spaces reserved for employees? Now realize this does say employees. So interesting aside, 2% S corporation shareholders and partners in a partnership and proprietors, they're not employees. So we'll ignore what that means about potentially they should be paying tax on this, but hey, just skip that. So we're going to go ahead and say there. So if we have any reserved employee spaces, right, we have to determine, like, you know, if we have 300 spaces and, you know, let's say 30 of them are reserved for various employees, then basically 1/10 of our cost immediately has to be disallowed or treated as unrelated business taxable income if we're not for profit. So reserved spaces automatically take their share of the cost. Now, once we take those reserve spaces out, now, so I've taken those 30 spaces out, I still have 270 spaces available. The IRS then got a little creative here. They decided, since this comes under 274A as our disallowance, that we're going to treat these as entertainment expenses. And one of your exceptions under 274E says that we will not treat an item as entertainment if it is generally available to the general public. So the question becomes, is our additional parking primarily available to the general public? If it is primarily available at no charge to the general public, then you're done. So for instance, I have 270 spaces. I have 20 employees who are not part of the reserved employee group. Well, I'm using 20, and on an average business day, so I'm going to have 20 cars in my lot on average business day for those 20 employees. Well, that's 20 of the 270 slots that are still being used. That's significantly less than 50% usage. So that means it's primarily available to the general public. So I can ignore those 20 employees, right? Okay. Let's say it's a little different. Now, like if I'm a retailer, that's highly likely to be the result. Even for us as a professional firm, we like to have parking available so our clients don't run out of parking. You know, people come by late in tax season and pick up tax returns. So we have what may be called excess parking, largely because, you know, we want to make sure everybody has space to park regardless. So in our case, yeah, we beat it. We have, I think in total in my office, we have 16 spaces. Of those 16 spaces, we have 5 employees. So, you know, we're looking at 5 of the 16 spaces get used. None are reserved. Bingo. Primarily available to general public. No add back. So you should have figured out one thing from there real quick. If you don't have reserved spaces and you have at least twice as many spaces as you have employees normally parked in that lot, you could kind of avoid the whole issue. But let's assume that's not the case. If you decide, let's say that we had, of those 16 spaces, that we had 12 employees. So only have 4 spaces that are open to the general public. We have to then go in and take a look at spaces that are reserved for customers. So let's say that we had that 16 spaces. You know, we have that. They're normally used 12. 2 of those spaces are reserved for customers. You know, they say client use only. They're up toward the front. Client use only, 2 reserved spaces. Those 2 reserved spaces for clients, those will be deductible. So I would take 2/16 of the cost out of there. Okay. Now, then I'd go back. Now I'd take a look at, I got 14 remaining spaces. I would then divide up 12/14 of the remaining costs would be disallowed because on an average day, 12 spaces are used by employees. There are 14 total, you know, open spaces. So 12/14 are for employees. I disallow that. Bingo, we're done. So again, this is the 4-step method found in NOS 2018-99. The IRS goes through 10 separate examples of how to apply this test. Okay, somewhat interesting and useful. This is our 4-step test. Now, officially it says you can use any reasonable basis to come up with a number, but this is the one safe harbor they offer. I suspect most people will use the 4-step test. Now, other things to notice about this, as I said, if you have significant non-employee parking, then you just worry about reserve spaces. So again, if you can convince the CEO of your not-for-profit to give up his reserve space, and let's say you're a not-for-profit that sees a lot of, you know, a lot of your work is clientele, you know, people who are being served by the organization come to you, then yeah, if you get the CEO to give up reserve spots, then we get rid of the UBTI issue. Get CEO and others to give that up. We're good. If, however, you're not regularly visited by your customers or those you serve in a not-for-profit, that could be a bigger problem because you're probably only running a parking lot big enough for your employees. That's where we're going to see a lot of potential issues where the disallowance could get more expensive. And the other problem is this notice doesn't really tell us how to divide. You know, let's say I'm paying $6,000 a month to rent my office space. And I get to use part of the parking lot. This is like, you know, a general office complex. How do I determine how much I'm paying for the right to use some number of the spaces in this general lot in front of the building? Now, clearly I'm paying for it because if that wasn't there, if that lot wasn't there, a lot of people, you know, all the people in the building could get out of their lease because that was part of what the landlord is supposed to provide. But how we do that allocation, your guess is as good as mine. We may see Congress repeal this provision. I would keep an eye on it. I would probably even try to go, since they may do it retroactively, I would even suggest that extending returns may make a lot of sense in this area, just to keep from having a problem there. Okay. Now, a couple of other issues. Notice 2018-100 was issued at the same time. It provides, if you are a not-for-profit who's now being hit with the parking lot tax, right? You have an underpayment penalty because, you know, you should have paid estimated taxes. You didn't have a 990T last year, so you can't qualify for the exception. If you're in that position, you're filing it this year because of the parking lot tax, you didn't have to file previously, you can, in essence, get a waiver of the underpayment of estimated tax payments. This notice tells you very simply, you do it by putting a notice 2010-100 at the top of the form 990T to indicate you're asking for relief, and you can get out of it. Okay, one more case this week. We have the United States versus Ulasi et al. This is from the United States District Court for the Southern District of Texas. It's case number 4:17-CV01164. The opinion came down on December the 11th. In this case, we have taxpayers. And this is actually not Ulasi. Ulasi is actually the one who kind of would hope they lose this case. Because then it'd be more responsible persons. Everybody agreed, apparently, Ulasi was responsible. This involves 2 other, a husband and wife, who also owned this home health care service. This home health care service offered services. They basically contracted via Medicaid to offer home health care services to various parties. This thing got behind in paying its payroll taxes. Now, it did so, and the 2 taxpayers here were aware it had gotten behind. But they, you know, they thought that the things had been moving to take care of. They kind of, Ulasi was moving forward on handling it. And they then actually went to Nigeria and were involved in doing work in Nigeria for a number of years. So they were both out of the country for a number of years while the taxes, yet not unknown to them, Ulasi went back to, hey, I need money to pay the bills. He did not actually pay all the payroll taxes. They get back to the U.S. They discovered that, you know, these taxes hadn't been paid when they took back over the books after they came back to the U.S. Even after doing that, though, they did allow other creditors to be paid before they took care of, before they started trying to apply funds to all these years that the money hadn't been paid for. That's also a normal reaction of a lot of people, right? You're a home health care service. You're providing a benefit. You know, you're providing services for people, you know, that are in need. You're doing this under contract. You obviously have to meet the standards of Canadian business. If you took all the money and threw it at the payroll taxes, you'd be out of business, right? And you still have a lot of the taxes not paid. So they do the thing that always happens in this case. They pay somebody else. Paying somebody else is a problem. They argued that they should not be responsible parties. The IRS finally got tired, went to court, went after all of the shareholders, officers, shareholders in this organization. We're talking about the husband and wife now who were in Nigeria for most of this time period. While they didn't look at the books, they said, hey, we had no access to the books while we were in Nigeria. You know, we left it all to this guy in Texas to take care of it. The court pointed out, A, you can't delegate your authority away. They had the ability to pay the taxes, they could. Even though they didn't look at these books and records, the court said it's very clear you could have at any time. You came back to Texas regularly. When you finally did come back permanently, it wasn't as if your other shareholder stopped you from taking over the books. You know, there's no issue that he was hiding things from you. You know, you just didn't bother to look because you were in Nigeria and he was in Texas. They said, and because of that, since you could have seen the books, you're still responsible persons. And by the way, it doesn't help matters that when they came back and discovered the shortfall, that they began paying other parties. Again, that always puts you in trouble. Responsible person problems, the catch is it goes directly against what you'd want to do. That's what makes it such a pain because, in essence, most often the way you avoid responsible person penalties in a case like this where you own the company is you virtually have to shut it down. You end up with no option but to do a virtual shutdown unless you can reach in your own pocket and pay the taxes immediately. And most often, you're not in this mess because you had the tons of money sitting aside that you could reach in your pocket and pay the taxes immediately. Well, hey, we're getting toward the end of the year. I do want to remind you, most state CPA societies now, a lot of state CPA societies are now shut down for the holidays in terms of CPE. As I said, I still have two more days in Arizona. Arizona will also, as always, I believe Pat Garvick's going to do his pair of, you know, two-day update, the last 2 days of the year as well. So there's a little bit in some states, but not a whole lot going on these last 2 weeks. But most states do have some offerings in January. So you may want to take a look what's happening there. I know I'm going to be going into Oregon in January. I'm also going to be doing some courses here in Arizona. I'm going to be doing a lot of in-house classes, kind of late in the year to try to set up an in-house training session. But I suppose you wanted to try, you might be able to find a date for somebody. So if you do, you can contact your state CPA society. They can contact us and we could try to get something together. Again, kind of late, but still, I guess we still maybe turn something up. But be sure you check those state CPA society listings. By the way, we're going to have this. And don't forget, there's a really good chance sometime in January, we're going to be having the final regs under 109 Cap A. When that happens, look for additional coursework. It may be webinars. It may be other things. But I would suspect at least some sort of courses are going to pop up, at least like two-hour webinars, if nothing else, depends on how many changes we have, that are going to go through the final regs on Cap A. So keep your eyes out for that. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of December the 17th, 2018. As always, you can get our regular updates online, currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can send any questions or comments to me, edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. If you want to follow me on Twitter, there I'm @edzollers. You can see some discussions we have there. I also follow discussions on various posting boards on the internet. I do the Reddit group, which is reddit.com/rtax/taxpros. You want to go in there. You can post some things there and post questions. If you are a member of Arizona societies, the Arizona Society, the New Jersey Society, or the Minnesota Society, I monitor their discussion boards. So you can ask questions there or run things there, and you know we can bounce things off that way. I also keep an eye every so often on California's Tax Talk group. and see what's happening there. Anybody can join that group now who's a CPA licensed in any state. So you might want to take a look over there. Again, if you have questions, that's a great place, not just to ask a question, you know, where I'll be much more willing to post an answer. Because by the way, I really don't mind posting answers in public forums. You know, if it's going to be totally private, then probably this is more an engagement. But if it's going to be a public issue, then yeah, we can discuss the issues there. Again, don't post any detailed client information that, you know, that gets rid of a confidence. We want to talk about a basic issue. We can talk about it there. You can check those locations. Well, next week's going to be December 24th, the Christmas Eve edition. And I do suspect I'll have at least something to talk about. But again, maybe not a whole lot more. I got the feeling Friday that the IRS was clearing out of town. So we might not have a whole lot happening next week, but I'll keep an eye on what's happening. Again, make sure you tune back in. We'll take a look at what goes on. We're also going to keep an eye out for when those final regs come out. We're going to look at trying to get something going. We're going to look at discussing it here. And to be quite honest, we're probably going to be looking at trying to set up at least some webinars or other structure to discuss those final regs, as long as they come out with enough time that we can do it before everybody gets deep into tax season. So keep your eyes out for that. Take care. And this is Ed Zollars. Hopefully going to see you back here next week. We talk about additional current federal tax developments.